Welcome to the Media Cat Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Mike Pigger, editor at the magazine. And today I'd like to welcome back a returning guest to the pod, Laurie Meekin. Laurie's the author of the book, No More Menemies, an award-winning strategist and co-founder and CEO of The Others and Me. Welcome, Laurie.
Lovely to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Yes, well, welcome, welcome. One of the select few of the returning podcast guests.
I'm honoured.
How's things going? How's The Others and Me going? Last time we spoke, actually, I'm not sure if it even existed. So maybe it did, but I didn't know about it. So I was wondering if you could give us an intro or a summary.
Yes. No. So it's going really well. We're working with some really interesting people and kind of working in two areas. So some of the work we do is about sort of leadership and culture and helping teams work better kind of across the gender divide, because as we'll go on to talk about a bit here, the world is increasingly polarized, especially amongst younger people. But then we're doing some really interesting work as well with some teams across kind of tech content and other areas, helping kind of them work out how can they take some of this insight and learning into products and services, which is, I think, what we're going to be focusing on talking about today.
Sounds good. And actually, I didn't exactly plan this, but our May theme is around people power and how trying to explore the ways in which power is waxing and waning between sort of people and brands and organizations. So I feel this fits pretty well.
It certainly does.
So when we last talked, we were obviously talking about your book, No More Menemies, about building a more gender equal world. This time there's obviously overlaps. And we're talking about an insight report that you guys have produced, The Power of Invisible Women. What's the report and why did you create it?
So great question. So anyone in who's listening to this who's read Caroline Criado Perez or knows about her will recognize the kind of reference to her in the title. She wrote an incredible book called Invisible Women, which basically just kind of changed my life, which sounds really dramatic, but it genuinely kind of made me understand a whole load of stuff that I just not realized about how the world is built for bodies and lives that aren't women's, which sounds really kind of dramatic and a bit teenage when I go, the world is built by and for men. But it is true in that everything from the kind of built environment, physical world, products, services, technology, content is all built over centuries to kind of center men's experiences, which kind of makes sense because there used to be such a divide where women own the domestic sphere, men own the public sphere. And so we see the opposite happen as well. In the domestic sphere, it's men who are largely overlooked, but in the public sphere, it's women who are largely overlooked. And the thing about that that's fascinating is it creates all kinds of problems for women, but it creates all kind of massive opportunity for businesses, because we know, I've sat in so many meetings over decades in media, marketing, branding, consultancy, where like getting a real killer insight or working out what could be a really interesting kind of product differentiation is like, that's the holy grail, right? That's what a lot of the time we spend our time looking for. And there's millions of them. What I discovered reading Caroline Criado Perez's book is there are millions of them all around us. It's just that we don't notice them because we're so used to the world being built as it is. And really importantly, a lot of them apply to women, and I didn't notice them either. I walked around in this body for years without ever actually realizing some of this stuff. So that got me so excited that I was like, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, started the business. And that's why we're working with companies to kind of go, there's huge opportunity out there to capitalize on women's spending power, because there's so many ways we could be serving women better. That's like really exciting kind of product development opportunities.
That sounds great. And I think you sort of did a somewhat of an intro to this for the magazine recently, talking about default male design limiting innovation, which proved pretty popular with our readers.
Excellent.
And
it's kind of fascinating. It genuinely is. It's like I was like a kid in a candy shop when I started finding this stuff out. I'm like, whoa, that's wild.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, we all know about some of it, right? So, you know, I don't know, make it pink for girls and blue for boys or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we're increasingly seeing more and more of that on social media of people pointing these things out.
Yeah.
And perhaps saying, you know, why does it have to be this way? I mean, talking on the media, I suppose, one of the things I think in your piece, you were talking about the sensationalist headlines that kind of, you know, fuel this kind of gendered, polarized world. how did we get to this point? I mean, you know, without kind of going back through the entirety of history, I don't know where do we start? Sort of the 90s, you know?
It's really interesting. And then, I mean, the 90s is a fascinating place to start, because the 90s was the sort of era of Ladakh culture, I guess, where that sort of feels in some ways. And when I experienced it, it felt like that was actually quite a gender equal world, where interestingly, it wasn't really. That was a world where we were kind of going, hey, girls can be like blokes as well. Let's celebrate blokiness. But women behaving like women was sort of very much relegated to the sidelines as a sort of sex object or as a mother figure. But I think what's really, there's a couple of things I think that have really made a difference. One is the Me Too movement has kind of created a massive polarization, and lots of the data that exists are kind of about the increasing polarization that's happening. You see a real change at Me Too, because I think Me Too was a moment where a lot of women, particularly younger women, but across all generations, were kind of going, right, enough is enough. We're not going to put up with a load of stuff that previous generations did. We feel empowered to speak out about the reality of our own experience. What happened as a result of that was like an acceleration of what's been happening for decades and decades, which is we've been talking a lot about women's empowerment, but we haven't been having parallel conversations with men about what does the world look like for men and what's the kind of future for men in a world where women are increasingly kind of stepping into their power. So often that feels like a threat. It can feel like a threat to men. Even the Me Too movement kind of often felt like a threat to men, because the fear of false accusation is like disproportionately huge when you look at the data, but it's a real worry to men. So all of that's been going on. Me Too made a big difference. And the other thing, I mean, it's like, it's so obvious, it almost sounds cliche to say it, social media algorithms, right? That just the polarization that exists, because as soon as you get interested in one thing, it's very, very quick to kind of go down a rabbit hole and end up in a world where that's the only kind of content and the only point of view you see. And we know that social media algorithms are written to prioritize sensationalist stuff and written to polarize. And that's what the media feeds off. And then politics feeds off that as well. And anyone who kind of wants to try and get a quick win can easily sort of, you know, do something that's like a dog whistle to one set of supporters versus another. And we've got this kind of us versus them, really unhelpful, increasingly kind of binary view of the world, which is just so not helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely agree on the social media thing. I do think, though, that perhaps social media is just a modern, you know, things like TikTok are just a modern version of, you know, tabloid sensationalism in some way, with a similar kind of thing. But
Just go from
print to a swiping phone or whatever.
Yeah, I think the only difference is it's harder to see the alternative. So It used to be that you could walk into a news agency and you'd see a bunch of headlines, some of which you agreed with and some of which you didn't. Whereas now sometimes it's harder even to see the ones that you're not agreeing with. So, for instance, I follow a whole bunch of people that I have nothing in common with and whose values are the polar opposite of mine. Because if I didn't, I just wouldn't even see that stuff. And if you don't see it, you can't understand it. So it's easier for us to be blind to stuff these days.
I mean, as well as the media, I guess politics feels increasingly heading in that direction, or if it's not already there, this sort of divided world. I mean, I think some of the things around identity politics as well, pushing that sort of stuff, or politicians wading into kind of conversations that are nothing really to do with them.
It's so fascinating, because like a few years ago, identity politics was something that sort of particularly the right would kind of go, that's a load of kind of woke nonsense, snowflakes talking about themselves and their identity. That's not like proper politics. And now, interestingly, it feels like certain identities are definitely being weaponized in the political sphere. And I'm old enough to have been around in the time of Clause 28. Where the same thing was happening again, particularly with gay men. We're sort of seeing it happening again now with trans women, where a group of people are sort of positioned as a threat to society and a threat, you know, particularly a sexual threat. Interestingly, it's a tale as old as time. It's been done to men of color, particularly black men. It's been done to gay men. It's now being done to trans women. Yeah, it happens when, I guess, fear is an easy thing to weaponize. And when people are feeling in a bit of a corner, it's something I think that politicians throughout history have always used.
I do wonder if the pandemic has kind of added to this. I think it might be our editor at large, Natasha, actually sent me a piece recently about how we're sort of turning into this kind of anxiety fueled people. I think it was more aimed at the US, but I feel like in the UK it's a little bit similar. And I do wonder if the pandemic has kind of added all this sort of anxiety on top of people, so that that's kind of put fuel on the fire of like culture war stuff.
It's interesting. It is interesting. I think definitely sort of mental health difficulties and anxiety, like the good news is we talk about it more. The bad news is there's more to talk about. But I've seen data, interestingly, that says one of the things the pandemic did was actually helped us understand each other and become a bit more tolerant and a bit more kind of nuanced and a bit more aware and empathetic. But I think maybe we're forgetting about some of that now. And it's basically, I think the economic climate is really difficult. Again, if you kind of chart back, any historians or economists listening will know that when you look at periods of economic difficulty, they are periods where, you know, kind of hate and intolerance tends to rise, because people tend to kind of double down on what they think is protecting themselves. Although ironically, often they end up damaging themselves as well by doing that.
Yeah, it's a funny old thing, because like you say, there's more talk going on, but at the same time, it's hard to work out if things feel like they're getting better or worse. I don't know, maybe different people have different perspectives. Some older generations probably say, oh, you know, maybe there's ups and downs. But we, ultimately, are we going in the direction of progress or not? I don't really know.
Well, yeah, it's quite set. I think the news around this is pretty depressing, actually, particularly, again, when I go with sort of a gender first lens, but then it kind of impacts on everything else. So the data is really, really clear and fascinating, actually, because what generally happens is each generation gets progressive. It gets more progressive than the last overall, around all kinds of things around this society, identities, kind of politics, social justice, a whole bunch of areas. And we're seeing the opposite of that now. So what we're seeing is a kind of a rolling back of a whole load of things around gender equality. So, for instance, now the majority of men in Britain, it was 53% last year. It's now in the latest study gone up to 59%, are saying that gender equality has gone so far that men are being discriminated against. Well, I think it's really important that we listen to and understand that point of view, because it's getting bigger. And it's not going to go away if we don't lean into it. And we know all the data is clear. Gender equality benefits men as well, but it doesn't feel like it is. So there's a big backlash. But the other thing that's happening, so there were fascinating articles in the Financial Times and The Economist recently that show that in a whole load of measures, men and women are kind of getting much further apart in terms of their overall ideologies. So in all kinds of areas, women are much more likely to be going, come on, we need to go faster. We need more progress around big kind of societal and political issues. And men are increasingly, particularly young men, kind of going, actually, we need to be more conservative. We need to sort of go be less progressive in a whole bunch of areas. And you're seeing this massive kind of ideological divide opening up between the way men and women are experiencing and seeing the world and the way they're feeling about what they want for the future. And that's not happened before in modern times, whilst all this data has been measured.
Yeah, I don't know if it was you sent it to me or somebody, or I saw some data around this, and it wasn't, it definitely wasn't just confined to the UK. They were showing thing in
all
Germany
around the world.
And parts of Europe and other places.
Yeah.
I don't know if this has given rise to like figures like Andrew Tate and stuff as well. Mm. And people just sort of saying, you know, oh, you know, this is terrible that people listen, but there's a reason. There's obviously a reason for these, you know, people getting these audiences. And like you say, if they're being ignored, it's not really fixing anything.
Yeah. Yeah. So for me, Andrew Tate, the thing that's really important to understand about him is that he comes up with all of the wrong answers, as far as I'm concerned. He's like misogynistic, violently misogynistic, which is not good for women. But also he's brutal about kind of men competing with each other. And the idea that if you're not an absolute top alpha, you're absolutely nobody. That's really damaging for men as well. But the thing, as you say, that's fascinating is that what he is doing is listening to men and understanding that men feel like they don't feel great about the future. They don't know what a positive future that includes men looks like, because they feel like they're being left behind. They feel like they're being positioned as the enemy. So he comes up with all the wrong answers, But what he does do is start by going, well, let's listen to men and actually take their worries seriously. We just need to give men better answers than what Andrew Tate's serving up.
Yeah, I guess throughout history, there's generally always, a charismatic leader has filled the void people have been searching for answers, and people will be desperate to listen to anyone that sounds like they know what they're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a void. And I think it's all of our responsibility, particularly women's as well, to step into that void and kind of go, let's have some conversations across the gender divide and let's work out how do we make a world that's going to work better for all of us. Because men, 59% of men aren't feeling like the vision we're selling them of a gender equal world is actually resonating with them right now.
And it could potentially be more, thinking about it. I guess it's just whoever said whatever their answer was in the survey, but in your article that you wrote for us, I think you gave an example, like talking about the struggle, the very modern struggles that the media faces. Like a very modern example was the Calvin Klein FKA Twigs advert versus the Jeremy Allen White one that came out a really similar time. One gets accused of sort of being sexualized and one doesn't. How do sort of brands and marketers kind of navigate around these issues other than expecting or perhaps anticipating some kind of ban? I don't know. It doesn't really help, does it?
Yeah, no, it doesn't. It's a really fascinating one. And I think, so I love whenever I talk about this, I talk about FKA Twigs, Kendall Jenner, as well as Jeremy White, because I think that really kind of talking about FKA Twigs and the Kendall Jenner images is really helpful. Because I think the first thing to understand about any of this is that sex and sexual, like in any kind of conversations about how are we representing people in terms of their kind of sexuality, we have to think about power and not just gender, not just sex, not just how much skin is on show or whatever. And it is nuanced and it is quite complex. And there's also kind of, in academic terms, there's something called the male gaze, which often kind of sounds ridiculous to a lot of people. But it's that notion of who holds the power and how are we looking at people? And if we don't understand that, it can immediately sort of things start to come undone. So, for instance, the Kendall Jenner image that I don't know if you remember at the time, she had more underwear on, whereas FKA Twigs didn't have underwear on. So the judgment seemed to be around how much body is being exposed and how much is someone showing us their undies, which is what we're selling, versus showing us a naked body, right? And that feels like it makes sense. But actually, as soon as you understand these sort of theories of looking and power and how are people looking and who holds the power, it's completely different. Because Kendall Jenner's image was basically her sort of sprawled on the floor, splayed out, sort of we're looking down at her. All the sort of semiotics of it are basically she's there for our viewing pleasure, whereas FKA Twigs was very much a kind of woman standing in her power, looking at us. She was sort of owning the power in that area. So I think that's quite subtle and nuanced stuff. And it's not as simple as just kind of going, how much flesh is on show? And then it gets even more complex when we get men involved as well. So again, it's really easy to make like a false equivalence where you go, if we position a man in this way versus a woman, it should be the same. And it's like, well, it's not. So again, an example I use, do you remember an ad from years ago? It was one of my favorites back at the time in the sort of Ladette years, a Lynx ad where there was like a guy on a beach, geeky guy on a beach, and then he kind of sprays some Lynx on and like hundreds of women in bikinis start running at him because they can't control themselves because they find him so sexy.
Yeah, I remember a lot of the Lynx ads from the 90s and they all sort of fitted and they won awards and stuff. And I think
they were probably one of the ones
that had to reinvent themselves the hardest in a way, didn't they? Like to get out of kind of 90s lad culture.
So this sort of thing, but I think it's a really interesting example to go, it's not just, you can't just go flip the genders and everything's the same, because that ad, right, has a man on a beach standing on his own. He's so sexually attractive to the opposite gender that hundreds of women run at him because they can't control themselves. Right, if you flip the genders there and go, imagine you made that and there was one woman on a beach and hundreds of straight men who couldn't control themselves because they're so overcome with desire for her that they're running at her. That'd read very differently, right? Because it's about power. It's not just about sex. So we can't always just go, oh, we'll flip the gender and everything's okay. Why is it okay to have a man doing that when we can't have a woman doing that? Because actually it's a bit more complex than that. It's about power and how we position and think about kind of sexuality and who has agency and who doesn't.
I think maybe in your article you talked about sort of like feminine coded stuff or characters like Ted Lasso was, I think, an example used.
I love Ted Lasso.
I mean, yeah, everyone that's watched it does, but I don't know how many, the people that haven't probably have no idea what's what
no, we're talking about. No, so Ted Lasso is fascinating because there's a whole bunch of things that are sort of from conversation to humour to the way things look, there are things that are masculine coded and feminine coded. So for instance, when it comes to humour, over hundreds of years, there's been a type of humour that's been popular amongst men because it reflects, that's also popular amongst women, but it's particularly, it's seen as a particularly masculine form of humour, that basically banter is the sort of king of this. It's a humour that models a conversational model that's more common in men and that we encourage in men, that's about who's up, who's down. It's like conversation is competition and you're trying to get one up on each other and sort of belittle the other person, and banter's the like comedic version of that. Our politics is based on that. That's one of the reasons that we're probably so screwed as well. But there's another model of conversation that is about, how well are we understanding each other? Are we closer together or are we further apart? Now, that's something that we see more often in women. It's something we encourage more in girls, and it's something that's therefore kind of feminine coded. Now, and there's a humour around that as well. The humour around that tends to be a sort of observational, empathetic, we're laughing with rather than at. And you're kind of punching up rather than punching down because you're kind of laughing at a system that just doesn't seem to quite work. Now, interestingly, Ted Lasso is a show that's about football. It's set in a football club. Most of the characters are male. And it's about this guy, Ted Lasso, who's a coach who comes into a kind of a premiership football team. And it's, but all of the humour is that kind of humour. And even his character, interestingly, he's a leader, but he leads and succeeds through a lot of things that are traditionally quite feminine coded, like empathy and, you know, kind of sense of vulnerability and collaboration and stuff, rather than the more sort of traditionally masculine coded confidence and, you know, and kind of competitiveness and whatever.
Yeah, and I think he spends most of the couple of seasons of the show, or at least the first season, kind of breaking a lot of that down within the club, like the players, how they act around each other. He even forms a little kind of bonding sort of support group with some of the you know, the managers and the coaches and stuff, where they essentially share their problems with each other in a sort of a male bonding way. But you don't see that a great deal on TV, if I'm honest.
No, you really don't. But then interestingly, you do see it in moments of real sport as well. So one of my favourite things, I love seeing instances where we do show men positive, powerful versions of what being, you know, emotionally intelligent looks like. And I think Ted Lasso is the brilliant kind of comedic example of that. But like every time England men's game, we miss penalties, it inevitably happens in every kind of major competition. There's always, you'll see a guy who breaks down, the guy who misses the penalty will always just, not surprisingly, just feel absolutely dreadful in that moment. There's always another player who comes over to him and gives him that support that he needs. And it's incredibly powerful. And we all see it. Every man I ever watch footy with is always like kind of trying to pretend he's not crying at that moment, but actually is. And it's just like there are those incredibly kind of powerful moments that do happen. It's just that we tend not to focus on them and we tend not to, you know, use those. I think there's so much area for us to play in, from comedy to drama to, you know, the kind of content of ads and marketing and everything, that can really just lean into this stuff. Because as you say, we're not using it anywhere near as much as we could.
Yeah, I think so. And I can't remember how long ago it was, probably not that long ago, but I learned, or somebody mentioned the whole way that men interact is side by side, and the way women interact is face to face.
Yeah.
And that just kind of, you know, one of those like light bulb moments. I'm like, oh yeah, I've been doing that my entire life. And I didn't even realize it. Like, you just, I was trying to think of like my interactions with guys versus women. And I don't know if everybody else is like that, but I definitely am. And it's always guys are like focusing on a thing, an external thing, whatever they might be doing, like you say, watching football, maybe side by side, looking at something, whereas women face to face. I don't know how we break that down.
No, it's fascinating. It is fascinating. And a lot of this stuff starts so young. And interestingly, it's not because men are naturally just predetermined to be like that. So much of it starts like ridiculously young with kids in the way that we encourage them to behave. So we do, like, even now, boys are generally, even really tiny boys, will be much more encouraged to be less emotional. When they fall down, they sort of get up, brush it off, get on with it, to compete against each other, to value, you know, being big and strong and not crying and all that kind of stuff. And we encourage girls to have, you know, to stop and talk and think about how each other's feeling and to process emotions and to read them in others. That has positives in some ways. It has negatives as well, because we tend to, you know, expect girls to sort of put other people's feelings and emotions first and to sort of make sure that everyone else is happy before they make sure that they're happy. But in the same way as with men and boys, we're kind of, it's no wonder that men's mental health is in so much crisis, and suicide is the biggest killer amongst men under 45, which I just always find absolutely shocking and awful, because we're not creating space for people to be able to play across like the whole range of gendered emotions. It's like there's some that we go, those are more girly, girls will over index in those. There's some over here that we just determine are more masculine, we encourage those in boys. And then we sort of pretend it's natural because we end up with men being more, you know, confident and less emotional, and girls the other way around, etc.
Yeah, I think you talking just put me in mind of, I don't know if it was Norwich City Football Club, maybe they had that advert where it's like two guys going to watch the football, and there's the really overtly happy guy and then the sad one, and you know where it's going, the sort of the advert, and you think, okay, the sad guy is going to be in trouble, and it was the other guy.
And it,
it was very much like...
We teach men to mask their feelings so much. Again, for men, admitting that they are... feeling vulnerable is a much more difficult thing, because we've taught men that that is a sign of weakness, and it's so clearly not. But having men be able to, so there's a lot of those campaigns, aren't they, about kind of ask a mate how he's feeling, but ask him twice, because the first time you're never going to get an honest answer.
I know we have to wrap up in a minute, but I wanted to just sort of, so it's not super doom and gloom, I feel like there's a lot of opportunities then to be had for fixing things within sort of media and marketing. Are there any particular things you want to touch on? You know, I don't know whether it's product design or how we portray gender roles in advertising or...
Yeah. So I'll touch quickly on a few. I think there's some things that, as you say, it's like, it's easy to get a bit overwhelmed by the amount of problems they are. But as every marketer knows, a problem is an opportunity for a brand to kind of differentiate and to solve it and to, you know, create huge business success by doing it. So there's loads of upside. I think there's some... There's sort of three areas that I think are useful to think about. One is bodies that are being underserved. So women's bodies generally are not designed for in all kinds of areas, whether it's cars not being built around a female body. I think that's quite a well-known fact now, but probably I still don't see much being done about it. But women are 47% more likely to be killed, 47% more likely to be seriously injured, 17% more likely to be killed in an identical crash, because cars aren't designed around the way a female body is, the musculature, as well as like the pelvis shape, as well as the size, etc. Football boots is another great example. So Nike Luna last year created a football boot that's built around the shape of a woman's foot, and it was hugely successful. There have been a few independent brands who've done it as well previously, but like literally I've been walking around on my feet for 50 years before I realized that they were a different shape as well as a different size from men's. So there's loads of opportunity to go, are we understanding how different bodies work, from medicine to fashion to physical products, services? The size of phones is another kind of classic one, isn't it? There's loads of that we're overlooking, that we could design products that fit women's bodies better.
I mean, haven't they only just added pockets to women's clothing?
Pockets, and it's still, you don't get it very often. It's hilarious. There's so many, like, you can go down social media.
So much progress.
Forever.
Guys, you've just been given pockets. slow down.
it's just bonkers. And when they do exist, they're generally so kind of tiny that you can't actually put anything in them. So there's stuff like that. In terms of like the lived experience, there's loads as well. So I think, you know, things like Bumble, when that first started, the dating app, was fascinating bit of insight it started on, which is the experience of being a straight woman on a dating app was not a very pleasant one for a lot of women. And the experience being the same for the tech, then the UX being the same for men and women, didn't serve both genders equally, because what men were doing in order to try and attract women was not what women wanted. It felt a bit kind of threatening. It felt a bit overwhelming. And women sort of wanted to feel more empowered. So the UX was created where women go first, women get to choose. Really interestingly, that works better for men as well, because the men get a good hit rate because they're not facing rejection, because they're doing things that other generations of men have told them women like, whereas that's not what women like. They basically just created a really simple solution that works better for both genders in that case, because that was about kind of straight men and women at the beginning, I think, largely. So like thinking about what are you overlooking, how is it different if you're for different genders, can kind of create huge success. And they're like, you know, company worth billions. And then in Adland, one of the other examples I love to use, because in terms of the stories we tell, the humor we use, the kind of the way that we code, the visuals, everything, music tends to be more kind of male cues and male masculine coded. But like even when we're looking at like characters in stories, we tend to go default male with those as well, which is fascinating. So a lot of the John Lewis ads have always been, we had Monty the Penguin, there was like Moz the Monster, there was, I think, Buster, the name of the dog. Most of those characters that actually aren't gendered, they don't play a gendered role in the ad at all, but we tend to assume things are male unless there's a reason to be female, which is kind of fascinating. And even the Venus Flytrap character, most recently, it's not gendered in the ad, but when you look on the John Lewis website, it's talked about as a he, even though like Venus is clearly a feminine character and name. So like there's all these kind of areas where we naturally default to the masculine. And there's loads of evidence that shows it genuinely does make a difference, because when women feel seen, when someone's made an effort, like even if someone says women and men rather than men and women in a sentence, we all really notice it. And it, you know, it might piss a few men off because they might feel like they're being left behind. But what it often does for women is to kind of go, oh, someone's actually noticed me and that made a difference. So there's definitely stuff in ads that we can do to kind of go, what happens if we think about the other half of the population that we're maybe just sort of ignoring? And it's especially important when you consider women's consumer spending power, like 80% of consumer purchase decisions are driven by women.
Yeah, I was going to say, even from a purely cynical point of view, if you know, you're a business leader and you don't really care about any of the other stuff, yeah. You might be like, there's probably a really good commercial reason to design things, you know, like you say, the football boot that actually fits a woman's foot, for example.
Yeah exactly. And I think that's what's, there is a lot to fix in the world. And one of the reasons I'm doing the work that I'm doing is because I want to make a world that works better for women and men and non-binary people, whatever their sexual orientation and gender identity. Like that's what drives me. But I don't expect the companies necessarily that I go and talk to care about that as much as I do. But where they can help is to go, oh, okay, if you want to make products and services that are going to be competitively differentiated, that people are going to seek out, that they're going to pay more for, that they're going to love, that they're going to talk about, work that people are going to love and notice more, that's, here's a way of doing that.
I mean, the industry is always going on about personalization. They've been doing that for at least a decade, saying, yeah, you know, personalization is better because, you know, if you speak directly to someone and they feel like this thing is made for them, then they'll more likely engage with it and buy it, etc. Which sounds exactly really like what we're talking about here in a way, just like make things more personalized to people's lived in experience, et cetera, rather than just a one size fits all.
It is. And it's funny because we tend to not like the idea of sort of putting a gendered lens on things and going, what difference does gender make? That almost feels to some people like that's really old fashioned. It sounds, because there's this sort of narrative sometimes that's like, hey, let's not even talk about that. Let's just make everything gender neutral. And actually, the really important thing to remember is there is no such thing as gender neutral. Things that appear gender neutral are generally default male, because it's not until like a football boot. A football boot, it wasn't gender neutral. It was made to the shape of a man's foot. So we need to be gender inclusive and not gender neutral. And the only way you can do that is to go, well, how is it different for different bodies and experiences? And how can we use that?
And there's another example with gender neutral of fashion, a few years ago, when suddenly there was a rise of all this gender neutral fashion, but it was all very dull and uninspired and plain, and it was almost like in trying to be neutral, it ended up suiting nobody.
Appealed
to no one.
Absolutely. And fascinatingly with fashion as well, because I think that's such a great example of how what we've done so far over like decades is made it acceptable for women and girls to play across a whole load of things that are either masculine or feminine coded. Right. So the simple thing is girls generally can wear trousers or skirts or dresses. They can wear girly flowery stuff. They can wear feminine coded colors, or they can wear really masculine stuff. That's all fine. 100 years ago, it wasn't. Women wearing trousers were like unbelievably shocking. But now girls can play in any of that range. Whereas things like skirts and things that are sparkly and things that are frilly and glittery are so feminine coded that we think that that's generally not available to most men. And if men do wear that, we immediately start to make kind of society makes assumptions about, oh, are they gay? Are they non-binary? Or are they gender non-conforming? They might just be a guy who likes a skirt. They may be cis, they may be straight, but we're so kind of the way we think about feminine coded things working for men has got a long way to go, because there's a lot of assumptions that we make about what's available to different men and what it means if men lean into that. That means it's sort of much more rigid, actually, than the choices that are available for women and girls.
Yeah, I have about 5 more follow-up questions to that, but I realise I should stop because otherwise we'll be here all day. And that's fine. It's good. But I imagine we'll just have to tell people to, you know, get in touch with you for more information, download your report, get involved, brands, marketers, and people in the media, etc. But for now, thank you so much, Laurie, for coming on the Media Cat Magazine podcast.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thanks a lot. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks.